Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Great War. The most brutal conflict in the history of civilization.
A century ago, 888,264 British men bravely went to fight for their country and never returned home.
Amongst them, over 2,000 footballers who went from standing side by side on the field of play to fighting side by side on the killing fields of the Somme. This is the story of those players.
Both Willie and I were trapped in a trench near the front in Somme, France. Willie turned to me and said, "Goodbye, Mac. Best of luck, and special love to my sweetheart, Mary Jane, and best regards to the lads at Orient." And no sooner had he jumped up out of the trench, my best friend of nearly 20 years was killed before my eyes.
We find out how the Great War led English football to crisis point.
On the home front, there was almost like a propaganda war going on between the critics of football and its defenders about, is it an unpatriotic game or is it doing its bit for the war effort?
We also discover how amidst the brutality and the bloodshed, on Christmas Day 1914, it was football that briefly brought peace.
It's about the humanity and it's about how men connect to each other. It's about the idea of finding something that they didn't have to speak about, that they could actually just do.
Football is the universal game. The fact of the matter is, doesn't matter what your language is, people can play football.
100 years on, we also find out how football is remembering.
We're a club that support the armed forces sort of all year round, and being the first ever club to wear a camouflage shirt for one game to represent 100 years was a great honour for this football club.
Ultimately, if it hadn't been for these players and the administrators, then the clubs that people follow today, they wouldn't be in existence.
I'm Mark Crossley.
And I'm David Cameron Walker.
And from the boardroom to the battlefields,
from the turnstiles to the trenches,
and from the supporters to the Somme, this is the story of football and the Great War.
Full-time scores. Football League Division 1. Manchester City 4. Bradford City 1. The Wednesday 3. Middlesbrough 1.
Tuesday, the 1st of September 1914. For football fans across Edwardian England, the best day of the year had arrived.
The sun was beating down and anticipation crackled in the air as thousands of men, women and children flocked to Hyde Road in Manchester, the home of Manchester City, and Hillsborough in Sheffield, home of the Wednesday, for the first day of the brand new Football League season.
Since its formation back in 1888, the Football League had rapidly been growing in membership and popularity. It was beginning to expand beyond its traditional heart in the Midlands and the North. There were two divisions plus the Southern League, and attendances were up.
In fact, over 121,000 crammed into Crystal Palace to watch the 1913 FA Cup final play between Aston Villa and Sunderland. Crowds were loud, passionate, and increasingly tribal.
Football was in the early stages of becoming the all-encompassing presence that we know today.
My name is Steve Jenkins. I'm Deputy Chairman of Leighton Orient Supporters Club, and I'm also the author of They Took the Lead. Professional football was really the big thing at the time, as it is now. I suppose it's similar in those days to the way that the Premier League's taken on board in this country. Certainly, you didn't have all the internet connections and the message boards and the websites. That's obvious, but
The fact that you would have supporters travelling to watch their teams across the country, you know, who would have thought that, you know, to go down to London to watch your lads play in the smoke, for example, or for the Orient to go to the South Coast as a day out, something special, you know. So the whole idea of professional football really was creating strength, identity with the local community.
So, just as today, football was in the blood. It was played in the parks, talked about on the terraces, and poured over in the pubs. It was part of the fabric of everyday life. But back in an age before the internet, TV, and even radio, how did fans know who the players were, and how famous actually were they? Mark Metcalfe is the world's most published author on books about football prior to the Great War.
Well, it's true to say that if you'd gone along to a number of grounds, it would be difficult to work out from the opposing side necessarily who players were. What would have assisted you is that the teams lined up in what was the 2-3-5 formation. So two fullbacks, three halfbacks, and five forwards. And if you were playing left winger, you tended to stick in that position throughout the game. It's not entirely the case, but that would be the situation. So that would be of assistance. What wouldn't be of assistance would be the clawing mud, which would be on the players' backs, particularly during the winter, and the fact that there were no numbers on their shirts until the 1930s. So that would have made it difficult. However, there were photographs of players in papers, and papers sold a lot of copies at that time. The real well-known players, however, like Steve Bloomer, Billy Meredith, Crompton of Blackburn Rovers, they would have been known in most places across England. And then Path News came along, and it then started showing the cup finals, and those were in the cinemas. So people, once they started seeing that, they knew who they certainly knew who people were, because everybody saw it. These were big, acknowledged stars of their period.
So, how else did the laws of the game differ back in 1914? Well, there were no substitutes, so players continued to play on even when heavily injured. The offside law was a three-player rule, and goalkeepers had just been banned from handling the ball anywhere inside their own half. Pitches often resembled quagmires, facilities were basic, and most players weren't well paid.
Clubs would take their squad of players, or a small squad, because in the main, the first team was the first team. The reserves were the reserves. They would take them away for special training. This involved additional training, but the central focus of taking them away was also to keep them off the drink. Working-class footballers were prolific drinkers prior to the First World War.
Even before the 1914-15 season had got underway, one thing was already assured. It was going to be the most controversial and pivotal season in Football League history.
On August the 3rd, Sir Edward Grey addressed the House of Commons.
I ask the House, from the point of view of British interests, to consider what may be at stake.
A month earlier, following the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and after a decade of rising tensions across Europe, disaster struck. Great Britain declared war on Germany on August the 4th, 1914, at 11 p.m. Here's Steve Jenkins again, author of They Took the Lead.
They Took the Lead is the story of Clapton Orient's major contribution to the Footballers' Battalion in the Great War. I chose the title They Took the Lead because that's exactly what Clapton Orient did at the time. When the country was in great peril, war had obviously just broken out in August 1914, but professional sport was still taking place. And whilst it was seen as a way of allowing people to get over the stresses of warfare and all the concerns about their families and friends that were over in France, it was thought a good idea that sport should continue in that format. And indeed, that's the way it was for the first few weeks. However, when the casualty figures started coming through and being published in the newspapers, there was a major backlash from the general public, particularly as regards professional football.
The hour struck. The ultimatum ran out. Sir Edward Grey pronounced the obituary of peace.
Cricket was fortunate because the cricket season had come to an end. Rugby was mainly an amateur sport at the time, therefore the game was curtailed almost immediately, and that left professional football to stand on its own. So when the bad news of all the casualties started coming through, the players were made to feel very uncomfortable. and instead of being cheered, they were actually jeered.
Hi, I'm Dave Yates, a Bury supporter all my life, and in the past few years I've been writing in connection with my work with the National Football Museum on the history of football. The players at that time, it was the retain and transfer system, and professional footballers had a rolling year's contract, and at the end of the season they were either retained by the club or they were put on the transfer list. So the players had a contractual obligation to the clubs. It was seen that football matches could be a good way for recruitment, as young men gathered to watch the local team, that people, the great and the good, would stand up at half time and start appealing for more young men to join the forces.
Oh, it's a lovely war. What do we want with eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam? Come for us, rake tar, we spend the money we earn. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Here's Mark Metcalf again.
There was a feeling that the war wouldn't last very long. That was very, very prevalent. And then eventually some of the authorities saw football grounds as good locations to recruit people to go off to war. So those were the reasonings behind it. By about, it would have been October, that there was a significant amount of negative press coverage. And in part, I think that was also a class factor came to play in this. Rugby and cricket were distinctly middle class. Football wasn't. Those who played cricket and rugby didn't necessarily rely on their living for this. The lads who played football did do so. Crowds were still significantly going through the gates. And I think that's the reason why football continued at that particular period.
Nonetheless, pressure was intensifying. The message to able young men, famously put by Lord Kitchener, was Britain needs you. But football was lagging behind. Alex Jackson is from the National Football Museum.
In its own way, we used to sort of the propaganda war, the First World War between the British and the Germans. On the home front, there was almost like a propaganda war going on between the critics of football and its defenders about, is it an unpatriotic game or is it doing its bit for the war effort? And it's absolutely fascinating sort of looking at those debates and sort of how they were discussed at the time.
In protest, newspapers decided to stop publishing football stories. Over the match results, attendances also dropped significantly, edging smaller clubs closer to financial ruin. And well-known public figures, such as Sherlock Holmes author Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, also publicly criticised the game. There were even calls in Parliament for the Prime Minister to introduce legislation that would stop the season from continuing. So, with the arguments rumbling on, and the British Army still dwarfed by their German counterparts, football decided to make a stand. Here's Steve Jenkins again.
The FA decided to discuss this problem with the War Office to see if they could get professional footballers and the clubs more involved in the war effort. Prior to all this, up in Scotland, there was a similar scenario with Heart of Midlothian getting involved through the local MP, Sir George McCrae, who felt exactly the same way and could feel that of all the problems that football was experiencing north of the border. And he had this idea of getting the Hearts team and also many other clubs, including Raith Rovers, Dunfermline, Falkirk and the like, to join up into the local regiment, the 16th Royal Scots. And overnight, public opinion was swayed. Hence the decision to form a POWs battalion in England at Fulham Town Hall on the 15th of December. The 17th Middlesex, which became more commonly known as the Footballers' Battalion.
Addressing the players that night at Fulham Town Hall was the Right Honourable William Joynson Hicks, who in an impassioned speech invited the players to a game of games against one of the finest teams in the world. It worked. By mid-January 1915, the battalion had attracted almost half the volunteers needed to bring it up to full strength, and by the end of March, it was complete. One of the first clubs to enlist en masse were Clapton Orient.
Captain Henry Wells Holland, the chairman of Clapton Orient at the time, was a military man by background anyway. So when war broke out, it was always his intention to get his lads to do their bit. He was actually involved with the committee at Fulham Town Hall on the 15th of December and was very proactive in encouraging his side to enlist en masse into the Footballers' Battalion. So it's no surprise that at that meeting, 10 Orient players joined up there and then. And their example led from to clubs from around the country to do their bit as well and join up.
Hi there, I'm Simon Bauer, work for the communications department for the Football Association. You saw whole sides going away together and it was quite an obvious thing, I suppose. They needed fit young people with good camaraderie and where to look would be football. And, you know, that's true to this day as well. You know, people still go to the bar afterwards. They play on a Saturday and Sunday in the freezing cold. So I think that's still, that camaraderie still exists in the grassroots game and right through to the Premier League.
The creation of the Footballers' Battalion, inspired by Sir George McRae and the 16th Royal Scots, also encouraged supporters to sign up. They could stand shoulder to shoulder in battle with their heroes, plus, in some cases, play football with them too. For many British men, war was an exciting adventure, a chance to escape the drudgery of the coal mine and see the world for themselves. Here's Steve Jenkins again.
We have to realise that at the time, most of the adult population hadn't travelled far. If they'd gone to the coast for a day trip or something, or out to the forest, it was a big excursion for them. To go on a train was not an everyday occurrence, let alone to go on a ship to go across to France, a foreign country. The chance to meet foreign people, to try and converse in a foreign language, to try a foreign beer. So you can imagine they would have been galloping and running to the enlisting offices to get their names put on the paper to join up. And not only that, but particularly with footballers, their natural fitness would stand him in good stead when they had to move around in the front line and dodge the bullets, if you see what I mean.
Every footballer that enlisted for the Footballers' Battalion was given military training, but they were still permitted to turn out for their club whenever possible. That meant the season continued as normal, at least until an Easter game at Old Trafford, which made headlines for all the wrong reasons. Mark Metcalf and Dave Yates pick up the story.
Yeah, I mean, it was April and Manchester United were struggling to stay in the first division and they were playing their great rivals, Liverpool. There were a number of players on each side who were involved in a betting scandal.
The match had supposedly been fixed to finish 2-0 to United. And when this Liverpool player hit the bar, he was surrounded and remonstrated at by teammates as to what the heck did he think he was doing.
Within hours of the game being finished, there were rumours that were circulating that the game had been fixed. And to cut a very long story short, it was proven that the game was fixed. And then seven players, including some who actually hadn't even played in the game, were suspended sin die, and one of them was Sandy Turnbull.
This guy was a United legend. He'd scored the very first goal when United played the first game at Old Trafford. He'd won the FA Cup for them against Bristol City, scoring the only goal of the game. He was a bit of a brusque character, constantly rowing with the directors about how much he was being paid, and he was a bit of a bristly character, but he knew where the goal was.
He was brave and he was exceptionally talented, particularly in the air, an all-round good team player. But he also had a bit of an attitude on him, and he was somebody who generally stuck up for himself and for his rights and for the rights of other people. There are some similarities, I would argue, with Wayne Rooney, both the way he played the game and his general demeanour, his attitude. He was a working class lad like Rooney is. He certainly never earned the money that Wayne Rooney acquired.
Now football is the present game, played in the sun, played in the rain, and the team that gets me excited, Manchester United. Manchester United.
He enrolled in 1916 and originally he was with the Footballers' Battalion, which were formed, but then he joined the East Surrey Regiment. He died on May the 3rd, 1917, when the East Surreys, they stormed a village 10 miles of Arras. He was a brave man on the field, no question about that. And he was clearly a very brave man off it. And subsequently, obviously, that's what cost him his life.
Fred Turnbull was the only current Manchester United player to die in the war. All of the players implicated in the match-fixing scandal later had their lifetime bans lifted by the FA in recognition of their service, including Turnbull after his death. At the end of the 1914-15 season, both the Football League and the Southern League announced they were going to suspend their league programmes for the remainder of the war. It led to emotional scenes across the country on the final day of the season as players prepared to join the millions in the mud. Here's Steve Jenkins.
Many, if not most, of the players had already signed up and them going to training camps, etc., having their medicals and getting ready to go to France. And there was no doubt that this would be the last occasion that the Orient supporters would have to see of their team before they went over to France. And so it was against Leicester Fosse, now Leicester City, a crowd of over 20,000 packed into the Orient Millfields Road ground. And the place was jammed to the rafters. There was scenes of supporters on the roof of the stands. And this can all be seen on YouTube, by the way. There is footage of this. Very minimal footage, no more than, I suppose, 90 seconds to 2 minutes, if we're lucky. But this footage was shown in the theatres in London, and I dare say further afield, to show what football was doing as regards to the war effort. The O's were fortunate to win 2-0, and straight after the game, the Orient players got out of their football kit and into uniform, and still, I dare say, sweating profusely, formed up with the rest of the battalion and marched around the pitch, complete the band, to a very emotional farewell before going off to their final training camp with the army before going to France.
So with Everton safely crowned as First Division champions, one of the most contentious and controversial seasons in English football history was almost at an end. All that remained was the FA Cup final, now known as the Khaki Cup final. Sheffield United beat Chelsea 3-0 with huge numbers of uniformed soldiers in attendance. Here's Dave Yates again.
The Earl of Derby, having presented the cup, made what became now quite a famous speech, where he was saying that now, having played all these games, there's now a sterner game that has to be played. And it was a kind of final bringing down of the curtain on football, and now let's get on with beating the Germans, basically.
Aye, shut up, you chap. Here's the colonel going to speak. My lad, before we set foot in the land of France, I want to say that we are now going to show the world what we are made of. We may have a tough fight, but you know as well as I do that we shall come out on top. Lord Kitchener has told you what he expects of you.
Get this. In total, 16 million people died during the Great War. Incomprehensible. Amongst them, 213 professional footballers. They were often living in the most claustrophobic conditions imaginable, in trenches full of mud and squalor, surrounded by gas, disease, and often under attack by shells. There are stories everywhere you look. The Victoria Cross was given to Bradford Park Avenue's Donald Bell, while Northampton Town's Walter Tull became the first Afro-Caribbean to be commissioned as an infantry officer in the British Army. As for Clapton Orient, well, unfortunately, they lost three of their star players during the war. Here's Steve Jenkins.
Let me explain to you what happened with the Footballs Battalion generally with the Battle of the Somme, which is one of the major conflicts in the Great War, as we all know. Whilst it's well documented, obviously the 1st of July was perhaps the blackest day in British Army history for casualties and the disastrous planning that took place of that that war. It didn't end after the first day. As I say, it continued into November. By then, it wasn't too long before the casualty figures were starting to hit the 17th. And the Orient, certainly the first one to, I suppose, lose his... I'm trying to talk about this in a delicate way, but with passion, I suppose, was Billy Jonas. He was in Delville's Wood with Richard McFadden, stuck in a trench together, and he decided that he had enough. Get to anyone mentally, I suppose, the stress of everything, and he decided to make a dash for the lines, but as soon as he jumped up over the top, one bullet finished him off, and his best pal, Richard McFadden, witnessed that. So he must... trying to put into context how you must have felt at the time. But I suppose if you think of any of your best mates, how would you feel if you heard about them dying suddenly, let alone seeing it happen in front of your eyes, and then having the character to write back? The next player to lose his life was that man mountain, George Scott. He was taken prisoner by the Germans and taken back to a military hospital. And it's whilst there that he seemed to have had a bit of a rough time. Nobody knows exactly what happened there, but for him to go downhill so fast, it wouldn't surprise me to think that maybe that he was given a bit of a rough time and he would have fought back and maybe try to make a run for it. But certainly he died of his wounds whilst in the hospital. And lastly, Richard McFadden, the ultimate star of the side. He was leading a line of troops along a trench near the village of Sayre, just a mile or so away from Daleville Wood. And he and his troops were hit by a shell blast exploding. And I'll never forget my first visit over to visit his grave. Would have been about, let's think now, 13, 14 years ago. It's the first thing I noticed when I looked at his headstone. I looked to one side, and there's a German headstone there. It felt really strange, but at the same time, a very proud moment for us to stand at the grave of Richard McFadden, thinking that probably no one has been there for almost a century. And there we were standing there, so close to one of the iconic players of Orient's history.
Dave Yates.
One player I did research was a Bury and Port Vale player called Alf Smith. He served in France, was at most of the hotspots leading up to the Battle of the Somme. And at the Battle of the Somme, on the first day, he was machine gunned in the chest. He did, as football began again in 1919, he did re-sign for Port Vale and played a handful of games, and then unfortunately his wounds got the better of him.
Another footballer caught up in the war was the legendary Fred Spikesley of both the Wednesday and England. He had scored the quickest ever cup final goal back in 1896. Here's Mark Metcalf.
He was in Germany when the war kicked off. There were a lot of footballers. There were a lot of people in Germany from England. What happened was that in the October, the German newspapers inaccurately reported that all of the Germans in the UK had been rounded up. In fact, that did subsequently happen, but not at that particular period. So there was a great patriotic wave which swept through the country, which said that the English who were still in Germany should be arrested. And there were about 4,500 were arrested. They went to a place called Ruhleben Prison of War Camp. The English consul who'd been in Nuremberg, he was pleading with the man to allow Fred to leave. That was having absolutely none of it. You know, you're fit, you're going to need to stay here. So he couldn't think what to do. And then what he decided to do was to get boiling water and basically apply boiling water to his leg. So when he appeared in front of the doctor said, "Oh, you're clearly not fit to fight in the war."
Going back to that instant when Richard McFadden witnessed his pal William being killed in front of his eyes, I still can't grasp how he must have felt at the time. And I suppose the letter that was sent back from the Somme to Clapton Orient, out of the blue, must have rocked the club on its heels. And the fact that the O's were adamant they wanted to publish it in the Orient programme at the time shows you how highly rated both players were at the time, and particularly at that moment, William Jonas. So I'm going to read the letter that Richard McFadden sent back to the Orient. The club received a letter from Richard McFadden, which read, "I, Richard McFadden, sadly report the death of my friend and O's colleague, William Jonas, on the morning of Thursday, the 27th of July, aged 26. Both Willie and I were trapped in a trench near the front in Somme, France. Willie turned to me and said, 'Goodbye, Mac. Best of luck and special love to my sweetheart, Mary Jane, and best regards to the lads at Orient.' Before I could reply to him, he was up and over. And no sooner had he jumped up out of the trench, my best friend of nearly 20 years was killed before my eyes. Words cannot express my feelings at this time. Yours, Company Sergeant Major Richard McFadden."
You
You're listening to Football and the Great War from We Are Going Up. Despite the barbarity and bloodshed all around, one story from the Great War still resonates more than any other in our public consciousness. TV shows, music videos, adverts, plays, books, and even podcasts have been made about it. It's still argued about by historians to this day. On Christmas Eve, 1914, so the story goes, on parts of the Western Front, everything went quiet.
Hello, I'm Carol Swords. I'm the curator of Pitsanger Manor and Gallery. Crossing the Field is an exhibition commemorating the First World War, and particularly a moment in it, Christmas 1914, where the troops laid down their arms and played football. It's quite an emotional story. It's about the fact that they started singing Christmas carols, and then they came out and they exchanged gifts. And the most extraordinary part of it all is they organised football matches between the two sides. It's actually quite bleak, the First World War. You know, when you look at how many people died in the Battle of the Somme, 56,000 in one day. I was looking for something of humanity in it, and when I realised that the truce had taken place, the fact that there was this laying down of arms and the fact that they did play football, and not being a football fan, it was quite revelationary to me, and I realised that it's about the humanity and it's about how men connect to each other. It's about the idea of finding something that they could both, that they didn't have to speak about, that they could actually just do. And I've actually sort of realised through doing the exhibition sort of the passion that football invites.
Open now at the National Football Museum in Manchester is a new exhibition called The Greater Game. Here's Alex Jackson again.
It's very interesting, the sort of the myth and reality that's sort of grown up over the last 100 years. In some senses, the myth has sort of come where there's been football matches, they've been very organised, there's like a formal scores and things like that. What is probably more likely to have happened, and which we do have some evidence for in a wonderful diary written from the time, is after the initial exchanges of gifts and trying a bit of sort of pidgin English or German with each other, that tin cans, or in this case from the diary, there's a little rubber. It refers to a little rubber ball being produced, and naturally a game took place.
My name is Bob Gamble, and I'm responsible for commemorative activity at the Royal British Legion. This isn't necessarily something that the historians would necessarily buy into, but my personal view is, having spent quite a bit of time in the army myself, is that it's worth remembering that the guys that were in each set of trenches, they weren't voting for war. They were there. They were a consequence of political decisions. But whether the guy comes from Lower Saxony or he comes from Yorkshire, the fact of the matter is they were stuck somewhere. They didn't want to be in the cold, quite close together. And the opportunity came up. They found the common ground, and the common ground was football.
Whatever the truth of what happened on Christmas Day 1914, even if it was just a kickabout, it does speak to the universalism of football and its power to unite, even in the most inhumane of circumstances. This year, the FA, together with the Premier League and the Football League, and in partnership with the British Council, launched a series of programmes and events under the title Football Remembers.
They included a charity match played between the British and German armies at Aldershot, watched by Sir Bobby Charlton, and joint team photos at games across the country. Here's Simon Bauer from the FA again.
The response that we've had from it is incredible, and that's from grassroots clubs, from under seven teams right through to the Premier League. And you know, it's gone across all the world because the Foreign Office, they sent out, you know, instructions to embassies from, you know, El Salvador to New York. All of them have been getting involved, so it's been quite an incredible thing. So definitely check out footballremembers.com if you have a second to. It's great to see that people picked up on it so early, and it wasn't just a case of people had seen the Premier League teams doing it, let's do that. There was a lot of communication from the FA side to the grassroots leagues, and also the players at junior level to get involved in this initiative. Other initiatives, one of the main ones, which was British Council and the FA came together, was to send out, it was around 30,000 education packs, which had stories of World War One troops and how they, you know, got by really in the trenches. And one of the things that came from that was asking the pupils to design a memorial, which would eventually be displayed at the National Memorial Arboretum. We had the Duke of Cambridge and Theo Walcott judging the drawings that were sent in by the children, and eventually whistled down, and a pupil from Newcastle called Spencer Turner, he was chosen, and now it's on display at the National Memorial Arboretum. It was unveiled on Friday the 12th of December, and the Duke himself was there to unveil it along with Roy Hodgson, Greg Dyke and the Sports Minister Helen Grant.
Whether or not you fully believe the story of the Christmas truce, the Great War was certainly a real watershed moment in the development of football, both at home and overseas.
In August 1917, a tournament was launched in the northeast of England called the Munitionettes Cup. It was the first real significant breakthrough in women's football. Here's Alex Jackson.
Women's football had been played before the First World War, but very sporadically and not on a sort of great scale. But what you have during the war is a lot more women sort of working in factories, coming together, and they're looking to have the recreation like their male colleagues, who often go off and have their own football teams or recreational clubs. And the women take up football, and it becomes quite a popular movement. And it also links in. It's not just for women workers to have a rest from working the long hours. It's also often used to raise money for various different war charities, raising funds for comfort funds for soldiers or POW funds, a whole range. And so in their own way, the women are doing their bit as well by playing sport and also helping the war effort.
The war introduced football to new countries and cultures, and it became a mass spectator sport overseas. However, when football resumed after the war in 1919, it wasn't all plain sailing. Here's football historian Mark Metcalfe again.
Clearly the clubs had lost some of their players. Many, you know, had given their lives. Others were badly injured. Some clubs had their stadiums damaged as well. Many clubs, because they didn't have any income, were in serious financial problems. But the Football League also was expanded after the war. So I think that was a demonstration that whilst football was struggling, there was definitely a knowledge that football was increasingly popular.
With the First Division expanded from 20 to 22 clubs, the Football League had a decision to make on the two additional sides. Manchester United's 2-0 win against Liverpool in the match-fixing scandal of 1914 was allowed to stand, which meant United survived relegation. However, as Mark explains, it had a knock-on effect.
It was agreed that relegated Chelsea should remain in the league. However, the other additional place, it was argued, really should go to the team that had finished second bottom in the league or perhaps third in the second division. And what happened was that Sir Herbert Norris, who ran Arsenal at the time and was an MP, he said no, that the team which finished sixth in the second division should get promoted, which was his team. Now, football had taken quite a bit of stick over the failure to deal adequately with the Manchester United situation. And Norris, behind closed doors, basically said, look, you've allowed Man United to get away with it. If you don't promote us, then I'm going to lift the lid on serious financial and political corruption within the FA and within the Football League. So what happened was Arsenal were in sixth place, were allowed to go up. It's my contention, and my Arsenal friends dispute this, that all of the subsequent trophies Arsenal have won, which is in fact all of the trophies they ever won, should be knocked back. But it's not a popular view.
100 years on from the start of the Great War, football and football fans are paying their respects in ever-increasing numbers. Steve Jenkins is the author of They Took the Lead.
It's amazing now that there's a football corner on the song. We've got the Football League Memorial, we've got the Orient Memorial, and then we've got the 16th Royal Scot Memorial, you know, where obviously the Scottish clubs are remembered. It is hard these days because although you can see the scars in the countryside still where many of the trenches were, the countryside's green rather than brown. At the time of the Battle of the Somme in particular. Although it started on the 1st of July, it dragged on until November. And by that time, the countryside was a quagmire. The reports of many of the soldiers that were fighting here disappearing, not just from shell blasts, but from drowning and disappearing under the liquid mud. But you go over there now, the countryside is very, very similar to Devon. You can still hear the songbirds twittering in the background, as they did before 7:30 on the 1st of July, 1916.
The footballers who served in the Great War are also being commemorated back at home, in schools as part of the Football Remembers campaign, plus also in museums and art galleries. Alex Jackson is from the National Football Museum in Manchester.
The Great Game is our temporary exhibition about football and the First World War, and we started planning this program about a year and a half ago, and it's a Heritage and Lottery funded project. And what we're doing is telling the story of football throughout the First World War, both at the front and at home, and looking at how it impacted on the lives of both players and fans. What's been really fascinating is looking at team photographs and medals and thinking, realising, well, actually, this guy played in, say, the 1920s, but he's went through the First World War, and you start uncovering these stories behind guys who achieved so much. We got a whole wonderful section about players who came back from the war and were winning England caps and FA Cup medals in the 20s, and there's three of them. Samuel Wadsworth came back and he was rejected by his club, Blackburn Rovers. Tom Wilson, who also played with them at Huddersfield, he came back and was rejected by Sunderland. Sunderland also rejected another young player from their reserves called Jimmy Seed, who'd been gassed, and they thought he was unfit, wasn't be able to play, and he went and played for England. He captained Sheffield Wednesday to two back-to-back titles. And so it's really you start trying to put these new stories to objects you already have. But at the same time, what's really wonderful is people with the centenary are looking at their own family history, and we've had families come in and loan us some really wonderful items, and it's just amazing what just people sometimes bring in. There's some actually fantastic stuff.
Carol Swords is curator of the Crossing the Field exhibition at the Pittsanger Manor and Gallery in London.
The exhibition is divided into two. On one side of the gallery you have an exploration and examination about what the First World War meant, what it meant then and what it means now, and about how artists are interpreting that. They're contemporary artists and they're looking at a historical occasion. And then on the other side of the gallery, you actually have the whole of the football memorabilia, the images, the photographs, and the sculptures of the stadiums. Jürgen's work are of football matches that take place in small towns, villages, on the sides of graveyards, next to water reservoirs, and they're all about ordinary people with not tens of thousands of followers but just 10 people playing matches. And I think it's actually set in small towns all over Belgium, but it could equally be England or anywhere else in the world for that matter. Our public relate to them very well because obviously they're extremely accessible images, and there's something about the passion for football even in these small towns.
Back in November, Millwall became the first English club to play in Army style colours when they wore a special camouflage kit for their home game against Brentford at the New Den. All proceeds were donated to Headley Court in Surrey to help injured troops.
Hi, my name's Stuart Locke. I'm head of retail at Millwall Football Club. I think we like to be different, and what we wanted to bring out of this is a sense of togetherness. And we always say over here we're a family, and we're a club that support the armed forces sort of all year round, and being the first ever club to wear a camouflage for one game to represent 100 years was a huge thing and a great honour for this football club. The shirt sold out within a day. We only first ordered 1,500 shirts, which we could have actually doubled the sales. As I say, little did we know the impact that we would have, not only on what we would call our Millwall family, the footballing world.
Bob Gamble is responsible for commemorative activity at the Royal British Legion.
Sport is an integral part of training. It teaches team spirit and it's about activity and working together and all of those things. But the fact of the matter is, at the risk of running a cliche, football is the universal game. So when you look at activities going on now, like the truce match, the fact of the matter is, doesn't matter what your language is, people can play football, and you find common ground. And we the Legion are quite actively involved with the current armed forces in terms of sport, because it's a platform that allows like-minded individuals to get together, have a commonality of interest, and from that work out what else we might be able to share interest in.
Christmas Day 2014 marks a century since the Christmas truce, when the shells stopped, the bombs stopped, the sound of war was silenced.
Not only did the Great War change the world, it also changed the sports we love.
It became the truly global game we know today.
The World Cup began less than 20 years later.
and the professional game at home soared to new levels of popularity.
Ultimately, if it hadn't have been for these players and the administrators, then the clubs that people follow today, they wouldn't be in existence. So that's what's important about the game.
It's just very poignant to sort of look at it through the lens of sport, because with, like, for example, looking at how these players from different clubs, those clubs in the vast majority are still here, and they're in some ways they're still a permanent, one of the rare permanent links between that age and now. Other institutions have gone away, but I think we can all still sort of bond over imagining what happened to the fans and the players of our own particular clubs.
Looking back and to see what was experienced, it certainly wasn't a nice place on the Western Front in those trenches. So we're very privileged to look back that those people did fight to have what we have today.
Football as this art of being able to speak to the world, and it's probably one of the sports that you can go to every country in the world and be able to talk to somebody across the table, bump into another football supporter, and it has a platform that everybody listens. And to be part of the sort of silence that we had here, the minute silence, and not even hear a pin drop, it just shows the respect.
...213 professional footballers died in the Great War.
Lest we forget.
Lest we forget.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.